Chapter 8. It was a new country to us, but it had the marks of the oldest countries. The road was a track over shelves of solid rock, worn by the feet of the caravans and the cattle, and it rose in the boulder-strewn unroadliness through a double line of trees and into the hills. The country was so much like Aragon that I could not believe that we were not in Spain until, instead of mules with saddlebags, we met a dozen natives, bare-legged and bare-headed, dressed in white cotton cloth that they wore gathered over their shoulder like a toga. But when they were past, the high trees beside the track over those rocks was Spain, and I had followed this same route, forced on ahead, following close behind a horse one time, watching the horror of the flies scuttling around his crupper. They were the same camel flies we found here on the lions. In Spain, if one got inside your shirt, you had to get the shirt off to kill him. He'd go inside the neckband, down the back, around and under one arm, make for the navel and the belly band, and if you did not get him, he would move with such intelligence and speed that scuttling, flat, and uncrushable, he would make you undress completely to kill him. That day, watching the camel flies working under the horse's tail, having had them myself, gave me more horror than anything I could remember except one time in a hospital, with my right arm broken off short between the elbow and the shoulder, the back of the hand having hung down against my back, the points of the bone having cut up the flesh of the biceps until it finally rotted, swelled, burst, and sloughed off in pus. Alone with the pain in the night, in the fifth week of not sleeping, I thought suddenly how a bull elk must feel if you break a shoulder, and he gets away, and in that night I lay and felt it all, the whole thing as it would happen, from the shock of the bullet to the end of the business, and, being a little out of my head, thought perhaps what I was going through was a punishment for all hunters. Then, getting well, decided if it was a punishment, I had paid it, and at least I knew what I was doing. I did nothing that had not been done to me. I had been shot, and I had been crippled and gotten away. I expected always to be killed by one thing or another, and I truly did not mind that anymore. Since I still loved to hunt, I resolved that I would only shoot as long as I could kill cleanly, and as soon as I lost that ability, I would stop. If you serve time for society, democracy, and the other things quite young, and declining any further enlistment make yourself responsible only to yourself, you exchange the pleasant, comforting stench of comrades for something you can never feel in any other way than by yourself. That something I cannot yet define completely, but the feeling comes when you write well and truly of something and know impersonally you have written in that way, and those who are paid to read it and report on it do not like the subject so that they say it is all fake, yet you know its value absolutely. Or when you do something which people do not consider a serious occupation, and yet you know, truly, that it is as important and has always been as important as all the things that are in fashion, and when, on the sea, you are alone with it and know that this Gulf Stream you are living with, knowing, learning about, and loving, has moved as it moves since before man, and that it has gone by the shoreline of that long, beautiful, unhappy island since before Columbus sighted it, and that the things you find out about it and those that have always lived in it are permanent and of value because the stream will flow, as it has flowed, after the Indians, after the Spaniards, after the British, after the Americans, and after all the Cubans and all the systems of government, the richness, the poverty, the martyrdom, the sacrifice, and the venality and the cruelty are all gone, as the high-piled scow of garbage, bright-colored, white-flecked, ill-smelling, now tilted on its side, spills off its load into the blue water, turning it a pale green to a depth of 4 or 5 fathoms as the load spreads across the surface, the sinkable part going down, and the flotsam of palm fronds, corks, bottles, and used electric light globes, seasoned with an occasional condom or a deep-floating corset, the torn leaves of a student's exercise book, a well-inflated dog, the occasional rat, the no longer distinguished cat. All this well shepherded by the boats of the garbage pickers who pluck their prizes with long poles, as interested, as intelligent, and as accurate as historians. They have the viewpoint, the stream with no visible flow, take 5 loads of this a day when things are going well in La Habana, and in 10 miles along the coast it is as clear and blue and unimpressed as it was ever before the tug hauled out the scow. And the palm fronds of our victories, the worn light bulbs of our discoveries, and the empty condoms of our great loves float with no significance against one single lasting thing, the stream. So, in the front seat, thinking of the sea and the country, in a little while we ran out of Aragon, and down to the bank of a sand river, half a mile wide, of golden-colored sand shored by green trees and broken by islands of timber. And in this river, the water is underneath the sand, and the game comes down at night and digs in the sand with sharp-pointed hooves, and water flows in, and they drink. We cross this river, and by now it was getting to be afternoon, and we passed many people on the road who were leaving the country ahead where there was a famine, and there were small trees and close brush now beside the road, and then it commenced to climb, and we came into some blue hills, old, worn, wooded hills, with trees like beeches and clusters of huts with fire smoking and cattle home-driven, flocks of sheep and goats and patches of corn. And I said to POM, "It's like Galicia."
"Exactly," she said. "We've been through three provinces of Spain today."
"Is it really?" Pop asked.
"There's no bloody difference," I said, "only the buildings. It was like Navarre and Drupi's country, too. The limestone outcropping in the same way, the way the land lies, the trees along the watercourses and the springs."
"It's damn strange how you can love a country," Pop said.
"You two are very profound fellows," POM said. "But where are we going to camp?"
"Here," said Pop. "As well as any place. We'll just find some water."
We camped under some trees near three big wells where native women came for water, and, after drawing lots for a location, Carl and I hunted in the dusk around two of the hills across the road above the native village.
"It's all kudu country," Pop said. "You're liable to jump one anywhere."
But we saw nothing but some Maasai cattle in the timber and came home. In the dark, glad of the walk after a day in the car, to find camp up, Pop and POM in pajamas by the fire, and Carl not yet in. He came in, furious for some reason, no kudu possibly, pale and gaunt-looking, and speaking to nobody. Later, at the fire, he asked me where we had gone, and I said we had hunted around our hill until our guide had heard them, then cut up to the top of the hill, down, and across country to camp.
"What do you mean, heard us?"
He said he heard you, so did Mkola.
"I thought we drew lots for where we would hunt."
"We did," I said, "but we didn't know we had gotten around to your side until we heard you."
"Did you hear us?"
"I heard something," I said, and when I put my hand up to my ear to listen, the guide said something to Mkola. Mkola said, "Buana," and I said, "What Buana?" And he said, "Buana Kabor, that's you." So we figured we'd come to our limit and went up to the top and came back. He said nothing and looked very angry. "Don't get sore about it," I said.
"I'm not sore, I'm tired," he said.
I could believe it because of all people, no one can be gentler, more understanding, more self-sacrificing than Carl. But the kudu had become an obsession to him, and he was not himself, nor anything like himself.
"He better get one pretty quick," POM said when he had gone into his tent to bathe.
"Did you cut in on his country?" Pop asked me.
"Hell no," I said.
"He'll get one where we're going," Pop said. "He'll probably get a 50-incher.
"All the better," I said. "But by God, I want to get one, too."
"Now you will, old-timer," Pop said. "I haven't a thought but what you will."
"What the hell? We've got 10 days.
"We'll get sable, too, you'll see, once our luck starts to run."
"How long have you ever had them hunt them in a good country?"
3 weeks. "Leave without seeing one? I've had them get them the first half day. Still hunting, the way you hunt a big buck at home."
"I love it," I said, "but I don't want that guy to beat me, Pop. He's got the best buff, the best rhino, the best water buck."
"You beat him on oryx," Pop said.
"What's an oryx?"
"He'll look damned handsome when you get him home."
"I'm just kidding."
"You beat him on impala, on eland. You've got a first-rate bush buck. Your leopard's as good as his. But he'll beat you on anything where there's luck. He's got damn wonderful luck, and he's a good lad. I think he's off his feet a little."
"You know how fond I am of him. I like him as well as I like anyone. But I want to see him have a good time. It's no fun to hunt if we get that way about it."
"You'll see. He'll get a kudu at his next camp, and he'll be on top of the wave."
"I'm just a crabby bastard," I said.
"Course you are," said Pop. "But why not have a drink?"
"Right," I said. Carl came out, quiet, friendly, gentle, and understandingly delicate.
"It'll be fine when we get to that new country," he said.
"It'll be swell," I said.
"Tell me what it's like, Mr. Phillips," he said to Pop. "I don't know," said Pop, "but they say it's very pleasant hunting. They're supposed to feed right out in the open. That old Dutchman claims there are some remarkable heads." "I hope you get a 60-incher, kid," Carl said to me.
"You'll get a 60-incher.
"Nah," said Carl. "Don't kid me. I'll be happy with any kudu."
"You'll probably get a hell of a one," Pop said.
"Don't kid me," Carl said. I know how lucky I've been. I would be happy with any kudu, any bullet all.
He was very gentle, and he could tell what was in your mind, forgive you for it, and understand it. Good old Carl, I said, warmed with whiskey, understanding, and sentiment.
We're having a swell time, aren't we? Carl said. Where's poor old Mama?
I'm here, said P.O.M. from the shadow. I'm one of those quiet people.
By God, if you're not, Pop said. But you can puncture the old man quick enough when he gets started.
That's what makes a woman a universal favorite, P.O.M. told him. Give me another compliment, Mr. J.
By God, you're brave as a little terrier.
Pop and I had both been drinking, it seemed.
That's lovely. P.O.M. sat far back in her chair, holding her hands clasped around her mosquito boots.
I looked at her, seeing her quilted blue robe in the firelight now, and the light on her black hair.
I love it when you all reach the little terrier stage. Then I know the war can't be far away. Were either of you gentlemen in the war by any chance?
Were we not, Pop said. A couple of the bravest bastards that ever lived, and your husband an extraordinary wing shot and an excellent tracker. Now he's drunk. We get the truth, I said.
Let's eat, said P.O.M. I'm really frightfully hungry.
We were out in the car at daylight, out onto the road and beyond the village, and passing through a stretch of heavy bush, we came to the edge of a plain, still misty before the sunrise, where we could see, a long way off, Eland feeding, looking huge and gray in the early morning light. We stopped the car at the edge of the bush, and getting out and sitting down with the glasses, saw there was a herd of Congoni scattered between us, and the Eland with the Congoni, a single bull oryx, like a fat, plum-colored, Maasai donkey, with marvelous long, black, straight, back-slanting horns that showed each time he lifted his head from feeding. You want to go after him? I asked Carl.
Nah, you go.
I knew he hated to make a stalk and to shoot in front of people, and so I said, all right. Also, I wanted to shoot, selfishly, and Carl was unselfish. We wanted meat badly. I walked along the road, not looking toward the game, trying to look casual, holding the rifle slung straight up and down from the left shoulder away from the game. They seemed to pay no attention, but fed away steadily. I knew that if I moved toward them, they would at once move off out of range. So, when from the tail of my eye I saw the oryx drop his head to feed again, and the shot looking possible, I sat down, slipped my arm through the sling, and as he looked up and started to move off, quartering away, I held for the top of his back and squeezed off. You did not hear the noise of the shot on the game, but the slap of the bullet sounded as he started running across to the right, the whole plain backgrounding into moving animals against the rise of the sun, the rocking horse canter of the long-legged, grotesque Congoni, the heavy swinging trot into a gallop of the Eland, and another oryx I had not seen before running with the Congoni. The sudden life and panic all made background for the one I wanted, now trotting, three quartering away, his horns held high now, and I stood to shoot running, got on him, the whole animal miniatured in the aperture, and I held above his shoulders, swung ahead, and squeezed, and he was down, kicking, before the crack of the bullet striking bone came back. It was a very long and even more lucky shot that broke a hind leg. I ran toward him, then slowed to walk up carefully, in order not to be blown if he jumped and ran, but he was down for good. He'd gone down so suddenly, and the bullet had made such a crack as it landed that I was afraid I had hit him on the horns, but when I reached him, he was dead from the first shot behind the shoulders high up in the back, and I saw it was cutting the leg from under him that brought him down. They all came up, and Charles stuck him to make him legal meat.
Where did you hold on the second time? Carl asked.
Nowhere, a touch above and quite a way ahead, and swung with him.
It was very pretty, Dan said.
By evening, Pop said, he'll tell us that he broke that leg off on purpose. That's one of his favorite shots, you know. Did you ever hear him explain it?
While M'Kola was skinning the head out and Charo was butchering out the meat, a long, thin Maasai with a spear came up, said good morning, and stood on one leg, watching the skinning. He spoke to me at some length and I called to Pop. The Maasai repeated it to Pop.
He wants to know if you're going to shoot something else, Pop said. He would like some hides, but he doesn't care about Oryx's hide. It's almost worthless, he says. He wonders if you'd like to shoot a couple of Congoni or an Eland. He likes those hides.
Tell him on our way back. Pop told him solemnly. The Maasai shook my hand.
Tell him he can always find me around Harry's New York bar, I said.
The Maasai said something else and scratched one leg with the other.
He says, why did you shoot him twice? Pop asked.
Tell him in the morning, in our tribe, we always shoot them twice. Later in the day, we shoot them once. In the evening, we are often half-shot ourselves. Tell him he can always find me at the New Stanley or at Tor's.
He says, why do you do it with the horns?
Tell him in our tribe we give the horns to our wealthiest friends. Tell him it's very exciting and sometimes members of the tribe are chased across vast spaces with empty pistols. Tell him he can find me in the book.
Pop told the Maasai something and we shook hands again, parting on the most excellent basis. Looking across the plain through the mist, we could see some other Maasai coming along the road, earth-brown skins and kneeing forward stride and spears thin in the morning light. Back in the car, the oryx head wrapped in a burlap sack, the meat tied inside the mudguards, the blood drying, the meat dusting over, the road of the red sand now, the plain gone, the bush again close to the edge of the road, we came up into some hills and through a little village of Kabaya, where there was a white rest house and a general store and much farming land. It was here Dan had sat on a haystack one time, waiting for a kudu to feed out into the edge of a patch of mealy corn, and a lion had stalked Dan while he sat and nearly gotten him. This gave us a strong historical feeling for the village of Kabaya, and as it was still cool and the sun had not yet burned off the dew from the grass, I suggested we drink a bottle of that silver paper-necked, yellow and black-labeled German beer with the horsemen and armor on it, in order that we might remember the place better and even appreciate it more. This done, full of historical admiration for Kabaya, we learned the road was possible ahead, left word for the lorries to follow on to the eastward, and headed on toward the coast and the Kudu country. For a long time, while the sun rose and the day became hot, we drove through what Pop had described when I asked him what the country was like to the south, as a million miles of bloody Africa, bush close to the road that was impenetrable, solid, scrubby-looking undergrowth.
"There are a very big elephant in there," Pop said, "but it's impossible to hunt them. That's why they're very big. Simple, isn't it?"
After a long stretch of the million-mile country, the country began to open out into a dry, sandy, bush-bordered prairies that dried into typical desert country with occasional patches of bush where there was water. That, Pop said, was like the northern frontier province of Kenya. We watched for Gerenuk, that long-necked antelope that resembled a praying mantis in its way of carrying itself, and for lesser kudu that we knew lived in this desert bush, but the sun was high now and we saw nothing. Finally, the road began to lift gradually into the hills again, low, blue, wooded hills now, with miles of sparse bush, a little thicker than orchard bush, between and ahead a pair of high, heavy, timbered hills that were big enough to be mountains. These were on each side of the road, and as we climbed in the car, where the red road narrowed, there was a herd of hundreds of cattle ahead being driven down to the coast by Somali cattle buyers. The principal buyer walked ahead, tall, good-looking, in white turban and coast clothing, carrying an umbrella as a symbol of authority. We worked the car through the herd, finally, and coming out, wound our way through the pleasant-looking bush, up and out into the open between the two mountains and on, a half a mile, to a mud and thatched village in the open clearing on a little low plateau beyond the two mountains. Looking back, the mountains looked very fine with timber up their slopes, outcroppings of limestone, and open glades and meadows above the timber. "Is this the place?"
"Yes," said Dan. "We will find where the camping place is."
A very old, worn, and faded black man with a stubble of white beard, a farmer, dressed in a dirty once white cloth, gathered at the shoulder in the manner of a Roman toga, came out from behind one of the mud and wattle huts. He guided us back down the road and off it to the left to a very good campsite. He was a very discouraged-looking old man, and after Pop and Dan had talked with him, he went off, seeming more discouraged than before, to bring some guides whose names Dan had written on a piece of paper as being recommended by a Dutch hunter who had been here a year ago, and who was Dan's great friend. We took the seats out of the car to use as a table, and benches and spreading out coats to sit on, had a lunch in the deep shade of a big tree, drank some beer, and slept or read while we waited for the lorries to come up. Before the lorries arrived, the old man came back with the skinniest, hungriest, most unsuccessful-looking of wanderobos who stood on one leg, scratched the back of his neck, and carried a bow and a quiver of arrows and a spear. Queried as to whether this was the guide whose name we had, the old man admitted he was not, and went off, more discouraged than ever, to get the official guides. When we woke next, the old man was standing with the two official and highly clothed in khaki guides and two others, quite naked, from the village. There was a long palaver, and the head one of the two khaki-panted guides showed his credentials to whom it may concern, stating the bearer knew the country well
and was a reliable boy and capable tracker. This was signed by so-and-so, professional hunter. The khaki-clothed guide referred to this professional hunter as Bwana Simba, and the name infuriated us all.
"Some bloke that killed a lion once," Pop said.
"Tell him I'm Bwana Fisi, the hyena slaughterer," I told Dan.
"Bwana Fisi chokes them with his naked hands."
Dan was telling them something else.
"Ask them if they would like to meet Bwana Hoptoad, the inventor of the Hoptoads, and Mama Tsigi, who owns all these locusts."
Dan ignored this. It seemed they were discussing money.
After ascertaining their customary daily wage, Pop told them if either of us killed a kudu, the guide would receive 15 shillings.
"You mean a pound," said the leading guide. "They seem to know what they're up to," Pop said. "I must say I don't care for the sportsman in spite of what Bwana Simba says."
Bwana Simba, by the way, we later found out to be an excellent hunter, with a wonderful reputation on the coast.
"We'll put them into two lots and you draw from them," Pop suggested. "One naked one, and one with breeches in each lot. I'm all for the naked savage myself, as a guide."
On suggesting to the two testimonial-equipped breeched guides that they select an unclothed partner, we found this would not work out. Loudmouth, the financial and now theatrical genius who was giving a gesture-by-gesture reproduction of how Bwana Simba killed his last kudu, interrupted it long enough to state he would only hunt with Abdullah. Abdullah, the short, thick-nosed, educated one, was his tracker. They always hunted together. He himself did not track. He resumed the pantomime of Bwana Simba and another character known as Bwana Doctor and the Horned Beasts.
"We'll take the two savages as one lot and these two Oxonians as the other," Pop said.
"I hate that theatrical bastard," I said.
"Ah, he may be marvelous," Pop said doubtfully. "Anyway, you're a tracker, you know. The old man says the other two are good."
"Thank you, go to hell. Will you hold the straws?" Pop arranged two grass stems in his fist.
"The long one is for David Garrick and his pal," he explained. "The short one is the two nudist sportsmen."
"Do you want to draw first?"
"Go ahead," Carl said.
I drew David Garrick and Abdullah. I got the bloody tragedian.
"He may be very good," Carl said.
"Do you want to trade?"
"No, he may be a marvel." "Now we'll draw for choice beats. The long straw gets first choice," Pop explained.
"Go ahead and draw." Carl drew the short one. "What are the beats?" I asked Pop. There was a long conversation in which our David simulated the killing of half a dozen kudu from different types of ambush, surprise, stalks in the open, and jumping them in the bush. Finally, Pop said,
"It seems there's some sort of salt lick where they come to lick salt and thousands are slain. Then sometimes you just stroll around the hill there and pot the poor buggers in the open. If you're feeling frightfully fit, you climb for them up in the crags, you knock them over as they stroll out to feed."
"I'll take the salt lick."
"Mind you only shoot the very biggest sort," Pop said.
"When do we start?" Carl asked.
"The salt lick is supposed to be an early morning show," Pop told us, "but old Him might as well have a look at it tonight. It's about 5 miles down the road before you start to walk. He'll start first and take the car. You start back in the hills any time after the sun gets a little further down."
"What about the Mem Sahib?" I asked. "Shouldn't she go with me?"
"I don't think it's advisable," Pop said seriously. "The fewer people when you're after kudu, the better."
Imkola, theater business, Abdullah, and I came back that evening late in the cool of the night and full of excitement as we came up to the fire. The dust of the salt lick had been cut up and printed deep with fresh kudu tracks, and there were several big bull tracks. The blind made a marvelous ambush, and I was as confident and as sure of a shot at kudu the next morning as I would be sure of a shot at ducks from a good blind, with a fine stock of decoys out, cold weather, and the certainty of a flight on.
"It's airtight, it's foolproof, it's even a shame.
What's his name? Booth? Barrett? McCullough? You know who I mean."
"Charles Lawton," said Pop, pulling on his pipe.
"That's the one. Fred Astaire, society's hoofer in the worlds. He's an ace. Found the blind in everything. Knew where the salt lick was. Could tell which way the wind blew by simply scattering dust. He's a marvel. Bwana Simba trains him, pal. Pop, we have them in the container. It's only a question of not spoiling the meat and selecting the more rugged specimens. I'll kill you two tomorrow on that lick. Citizens, I feel very well."
"What have you been drinking?"
"Not a damn thing, really. Call Garrick. Tell him I'll put him in the cinema. Got a part for him. Little thing I thought up on the way home. It may not work out, but I like the plot. Othello, or the Moor of Venice. Do you like it? It's got a wonderful idea. You see, this jig we call Othello falls in love with this girl who's never been around at all, so we call her Desdemona. Like it? They've been after me to write it for years, but I drew the color line. Let him go out and get a reputation, I told them. Harry Wills, hell. Paulina beat him. Sharky beat him. Dempsey beat Sharky. Carnera knocked him out. What if nobody saw the punch? Where the hell were we, Pop? Harry Greb is dead, you know. We were just coming into town, Pop said. Chaps were throwing things at you, and we couldn't find out why.
I remember, P.O.M. said. Why didn't you make him draw the color line, Mr. J.P.?
I was frightfully tired, Pop said.
You're very distinguished looking, though, P.O.M. said. What are we going to do with this goofy?
Throw a drink into the brute and see if he'll quiet down.
I'm quiet now, I said, but by God, I feel awfully good about tomorrow. Just then, who should come into camp but old Carl, with his two naked savages and his half-size, very devout Mohammedan gun-bearer, Charo. In the firelight, old Carl looked a grayish, yellowish white in the face, and he took off his Stetson.
Well, did you get one?
He asked. Nah, but they're there. What'd you do?
Walked along goddamn road. How do you expect to find a kudu along a road with nothing but cattle and huts and people?
He'd not look like himself, and I thought he must be ill. But coming in like a death's head when we had been clowning made me behave badly again, and I said, we drew lots, you know.
Of course, he said bitterly. We hunted along a road. What do you expect to see? Does that seem the way to hunt kudu to you?
But you'll get one on the Salt Lick in the morning, P.O.M. told him very cheerfully. I drank off the glass of whiskey and soda and heard my voice say very cheerfully, you'll be sure to get one on the Salt Lick in the morning.
You're hunting it in the morning, Carl said.
No, you're hunting it. I had it tonight. We're changing off. That's been understood, isn't it, Pop?
Quite,
said Pop. No one else was looking at anyone else. Have a whiskey and soda, Carl, P.O.M. said.
All right,
Carl said. We had one of those quiet meals, in bed in the tent. I said, what in God's name prompted you to say that about him having the lick in the morning?
I don't know. I don't think that's what I meant to say. I got mixed up. Let's not talk about it.
I won the damn thing drawing lots. You can't go against lots. That's the only way the luck has a chance to even up, ever.
Don't let's talk about it.
I don't think he's well now, and he doesn't feel himself. The damn things have gotten his goat, and he's liable to blow the Salt Lick higher than a kite in a state he's in.
Please, stop talking about it.
I will.
Good.
Well, we made him feel good anyway.
I don't know that we did. Let's stop talking about it.
I will.
Good. Good night, she said.
The hell with it, I said. Good night.
Good night.